The dinosaurs had millions and millions and millions of years, and they didn't do shit. Hey, welcome to episode 178 of Front Seat Gamer. I'm Nick. I'm here with Blake.
No, I wasn't ready. Hey, hi.
And Paul.
Hi.
I switched it up. I was looking at Paul and I decided to say Blake.
Oh, you threw me. Oh, my God.
And that was great.
I really enjoyed that.
Oh, my God. I feel refreshed.
How are you doing, Nick? This is like a completely different show now.
I'm fine.
Yeah.
It's Easter day as of recording.
It is. How many eggs have you eaten? Many eggs in your house?
I ate one. I ate a small Oreo egg.
Did you say you did a Easter egg hunt?
I did an Easter egg hunt with my daughter.
That's so cool.
Did you find more than her?
I didn't find any because I placed them.
Oh, so you already knew where they were.
In fact, if you want to talk about it, it was a little bit of like a design challenge in a sense.
Oh, no.
Here was the plan, okay? The plan was we had a basket.
Yep.
And we had like a big chocolate bunny in it and a few big eggs and lots of little eggs.
Yep.
And a couple toys and some slippers. Mm. Like it was just like a little basket of gifts and chocolate.
That's cool.
But lots, probably way too much chocolate for a three-year-old. She's not even three yet, so it's really an almost three-year-old. Anyway, the problem is we did a Easter egg hunt at someone else's house on Friday, which was just hard-boiled eggs, and was just like, it was like three kids, and the whole point of it was just to find the eggs.
Right? Okay, mm-hmm.
And
that is the fun part, to be honest.
Yes. Well, the hunt.
I like getting chocolate.
My daughter loves chocolate.
Yeah. Mm.
So there's definitely a fun part to that
too. I always found finding them more fun than eating them.
Blake, there's something wrong with your brain. Now.
I know. You see the games I play?
Uh-huh. Yeah. The problem was when we watched this like Easter egg hunt play out, like 3-year-olds are not good at finding.
Mm. They don't know what's going on.
Not really. They don't really understand. They kind of get it, but there's not a huge amount of motivation there. They don't understand like looking for things.
Yeah.
There's an implication that they already understand the environment, and they may not already understand the environment. So when I watched this play out, I knew we were going to do this Easter egg hunt, and we knew we were going to do this with a basket. And I was like, well, we want her to find the basket. So we were going to do a trail. Yeah. Right. But I also wanted her to have like the fun of looking for the eggs. And so we spent, you know, maybe an hour last night setting up the eggs in specific ways with specific eye lines and specific heights and trying to figure out like the order in which she would probably discover them and make sure that she's led to the basket, but also like so that she wouldn't shortcut the basket.
Yep.
She'd get all the eggs along the way, but still have the fun of like finding the eggs as opposed to just I see one there. And so like that was like a fun little challenge of like we'll make sure that there's like a stuffed toy animal obscuring it from this angle so when she goes to collect this other egg, she can then see it. Ah. And it worked a dream. We had like maybe 10 egg trail, maybe more than that, to get to the basket. Maybe it was like 12. And she only missed one, and it was only at the very end when she could see the basket.
Oh, wow.
Skip past.
Ah, yeah.
And it was a little one on like a stack of blocks. So it was totally fine. Very, very, very actually pleased with the
result. That is so cool. That is some real
fun little level design challenge.
Yeah, that was so cool.
It's a classic.
It almost sounds more fun for you than it would have been for her.
Oh, she had a good time.
Like, yeah.
But it was fun. It was like a little breadcrumbing challenge.
Yeah.
And I really got a kick out of it.
That is so cool. That's really cool.
No, it's the maybe the first time like game design skills have actually helped in real life.
Last time. I've heard you say before that your skills don't translate into the real world. Don't. Well, here you go.
Yeah, finally. Finally.
Finally.
The one egg, one Easter egg hunt, and maybe never again. Because next year she'll be old enough to like look for things, probably.
Yeah, you could still.
Yeah, that just means you need a increase the difficulty. Yeah. Right?
You could just build up like an escape room style.
That's what I was thinking.
This is like, here's a riddle with like some numbers, and then you have to like look up on a
board. Who murdered the Easter Bunny? Let's find out.
Do it.
You're not leaving your room until you figure this out.
You can have a great time and also there's come a hollowed out book
with a key. Oh, man, the murder weapon was a gun.
So good. I did an Easter egg hunt a few years back for my nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
And it was, we didn't put that much thought into it. They were much older than, they were like close-ish to 10, I think, between 5 and 10.
Yep.
And we just put them around. But what I did, I got some potatoes and mixed, put tinfoil around them and planted those around as well. So there were some like duds. You know?
That's good stuff. When we did the Easter egg hunt on Friday, we did, I don't know, 40 or so eggs, lot of eggs.
Yeah.
And we did it for the kids first. And then the host wanted the dads to do an egg hunt for the mums.
Funny.
It was just two of us.
Yeah.
And then, and like three mums. And we sort of tried to make the Easter egg hunt, but only the host really participated in the hunt. Uh-huh. So it really became one person looking for eggs hidden by three people. And that was fun because she's not that tall.
And
I accidentally did not realize I was using height as an advantage.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny.
Lots of color matching. Color matching is a really good Easter egg hunt hiding tactic. Like you put a green egg with a bunch of like green fruits.
Yep.
And like a white egg up against the white wall or whatever it is. You know, it's fun little stuff.
That's cool. That sounds fun.
Yeah. You know what? Turns out looking for stuff is fun.
Yeah.
Unless you really need it.
Yeah.
Put your phone.
Yeah.
Not a fun hunt.
Yeah.
All right. You guys been playing stuff?
Yeah.
I've been playing stuff. You've been playing stuff though.
I've been playing some stuff.
What have you been playing? What have you been playing?
I've been playing The Witcher 3.
Yep.
I played some Cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
I played a bunch of mobile games.
Yeah. Well, actually, here's the thing. Do you want to do questions up front?
That was a fast pivot.
Yeah. Well, you've just reminded me because we did have a question or a comment, a suggestion a while back about Cyberpunk.
Oh, you want me to read that one out?
Yeah.
Okay. This just says, Blake, that's why.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I assume it's a play on Blake Y.
It's you. It's from you saying write in and say Blake Y.
Yeah. Cyberpunk 2077, Phantom Liberty. For games to check out next and that are good, Nick. The Phantom Liberty update did a pass over pretty much all game systems, balance, and UI. So much has been added and changed. It's practically a different and better game now. On top, there are new gameplay elements. Phantom Liberty's story is incredible. I hope you check it out and discuss it on the podcast. Well, I haven't got Phantom Liberty. I've got the base game.
The base game did come more. With a load of new updates from Phantom Liberty.
Yeah, I suspect I've benefited from a lot of the balance changes. This is from Robin. He also said, P.S. I owned and played on PC my whole life, but in August we moved to a new flat and I got myself a big TV and PS5, which is my very first real console, not counting the Switch. And I'm playing Cyberpunk 2077 on the PS5. Man, is it fun to play on the couch. That's cool. Console gaming is fun.
Yeah.
It's funny that he says it's my first console, not counting the Switch, as if the Switch isn't
a real portable, right?
Yeah, it's a different thing to like having something to intentionally play on the TV.
Quality. I play it mostly on the TV.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah, so do I. It's still different though.
Yeah, I suppose like the portableness is like just a neat extra thing, I think.
It's also significantly lower powered.
So it's not a real console?
I didn't say that. That was Rob. Rob said that. Thanks for writing in, Rob. Do you want me to read out some other things?
Yeah, sure, I guess.
We'll talk about Phantom Liberty if and when one of us plays it.
I have been planning to play it because I had a great time. I think I talked about it on the podcast maybe like a year ago. I had a really great time restarting Cyberpunk and playing with a katana blade build and just activating slow-mo and just slicing off heads. And then the slow-mo stops and all the enemies just drop to the ground like real anime style. So much fun.
It does sound fun. I've been playing as a net runner.
Oh.
So I've been making people set themselves on fire.
Oh, that's cool. And,
spread disease.
Spread disease?
Yeah, it feels a bit like a turn-based game.
Oh, okay.
Because, like, you go into scan mode.
Yeah.
And then you just go, okay, overheat, 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 contagion.
Oh.
And, like, they all kind of catch on fire and, yep. and disease spreads and then they all fall over dead. And I'm just standing around the corner waiting for it to happen.
Just waiting for the room to be clear.
Yeah. Like a brave, like a big brave boy.
Yep. Well, you've been doing things of like you hack into the camera and then you can see another camera from that and you hack into that. And it like
you can
leads a trail to like a specific thing and then you can hack someone from there.
Not so much that. Not so much that. But that's just because I don't think I'm that far in. Like I was, 7 or 8 hours in before I saw the titles?
Oh, yeah. Holy hell.
I didn't realize. I mean, I got sidetracked a bit.
Yeah.
I like going around with scan mode on, just seeing all of the gang members who are in normal society and setting them on fire and making them spread disease.
That's cool. That's so cool. What a world to live in, man. You could just be killed in an instant. From, you don't even know someone's looking at
you're,
you.
You're eating down, you're sitting down eating your noodles, and then suddenly your head catches on fire and you die.
Like, this seems really unsafe.
Real grim. How's that Neuralink going, Elon? That sounds like a fun technology. Let's definitely all bank on that.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Witcher 3, really fun. Gwent.
Oh, you get hooked onto Gwent.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like the only one that I know that didn't care about Gwent. Everyone else is like...
Yeah, but you didn't play much Hearthstone.
I played a lot of Hearthstone.
No, you didn't.
Yeah.
Not by normal methods.
You mean not by... Like, from my standards, I played a lot. But you're saying from Hearthstone player standards, I barely played it.
Yeah, correct.
You're probably.
What else? Why didn't you like Gwent?
I don't know, man. I honestly was like, this gets in the way of the game.
How does that? How at all does that the case? Because you didn't. It's not like you're ever forced to play Gwent.
No, you're not. You're not. But ever. I just never engaged with it.
The game.
I was just
I keep selecting this option.
I've always been like that though, because so Final Fantasy, right? They've had mini games. I remember there was like one that had a card game.
8 was the first one with the card
game. Yeah. And I literally like, I remember everyone telling me how, like, they're like, oh man, this is so great. I never engaged with it because I was like, I just feel like I'd rather play the actual game.
But the thing is, you can do both. Like, you could do them in sequence.
Well, Lake's furiously shaking his head.
Yeah. For the audio.
Yeah. Lake is, he's scrunched up his face like he's just eaten a lemon.
Yeah, as I'm now. No.
I do kind of get what he means, though, is that, like, I do get sucked into these things as well and spend way too long.
Yeah, Blitzball.
Doing them.
Blitzball, that was 10, right?
Yeah,
10. See, I didn't play 10 much. I played one round of that and was like, I'm not doing this.
What is wrong with you?
I was like, I'm going to play the actual game.
It's part of the game. It is the actual game.
I'm shaking my head again.
Oh, boy. Oh, dear.
Well, in Witcher, like, I do get it, because in Witcher, it's really well integrated into the world, because you can just go to these taverns, and there's, like, a whole tournament system, right? Like, you go around the world, go into these taverns, taking out certain players, and...
Yeah, you can get unique cards
by talking. Like, there's a whole thing. I have friends who are, like... Like when they played that game, it basically turned into Gwent Simulator, where they just are going from tavern to tavern playing Gwent.
Everything I do is to supplement my ability to find new cards.
See? But that's great. That everyone loves that game. So I guess good on them for actually making a really cool card game.
I think that's a much better fiction as well. If it is a guy who is a Monster Slayer to specifically supplement his... like crippling card game addiction. all right. Oh, Witcher's in town. Oh, I got a monster slay. Okay, but do you have Gwent? Do you have cards? Yeah. But can you slay the monster first? Yeah. Come on, hurry up.
It's like, oh, I really want to buy this shiny card, but I'm gonna have to kill some harpies.
Genuinely, my first few hours was really like weighing up. And now I've got like a good surplus of coin, but for a while it was like, I can buy the card, or I can repair my gear.
Man, that's so funny.
Really a difficult.
That is an actual gambling addiction that you've got there. It's like, I could take care of myself, or I could buy more cards.
Yeah. But you can also earn money through playing cards.
Yeah, I know. So I know. It's a really, like, it didn't click with me. I just was like.
It sounds like no minigame has ever clicked with you, though.
Yeah, I'm not a minigame kind of guy.
How about, did Final Fantasy IX have one?
I don't think I played much 9. I played a lot of 7 and 8.
I played a lot of 9, but I don't remember.
9 had mini games, but I don't think it had like a mini game meta the way 8 and 10 did. And like the new 7 has like a whole
card game
thing.
Yeah, I know. I remember you guys talking about all these like mini games and stuff in 7. And I mean, they sound cool, but it sounds like a thing I would do once and then be like, okay, that's it.
There's like chocobo racing in the original Final Fantasy 7. Yeah. Where like, you'd raise your chocobos and then you'd race your chocobos.
Yeah, I think I did the chocobo racing once.
Good.
I don't have
what
time.
What do you do when you play your games?
I just play them.
But clearly you don't.
I just don't engage.
He's okay with playing
games.
The game, just not the game within the game.
Yeah, I don't play the game within the game.
You know what? I now understand the problem. Is that these little games have endings to them? Like, they have win conditions.
What they need.
And you do it and you go, oh, I won. How boring. And I want something that just goes on forever. I want a version of Tetra Masters where I keep laying down cards. It's just the grid is 500 by 500. And we just take turns putting cards in the grid. And then at some point I just turn it off. That's what I want.
Yep, that sounds right. If they, in the next GTA, if they have like early access mini games that you can play, then
probably get those. Yeah. Just like it's broken and like half the mechanics don't work.
You're not going to play Phantom Liberty because it's not buggy enough. I liked Cyberpunk when it first came out.
Yeah.
I liked it when everyone was eating invisible hot dogs.
Back in the good old days.
Yeah. That's when I really connected with it, you know.
Do you find that with any of the early access games you play, they come out for release?
Like,
do you play them? You don't play them at all.
I've played the thing is, most of them I don't. And this is why, like, you guys joke that I always buy early access games, but I've really put a lid on that.
What was the last game you bought?
Dragon's Dogma. Dragon's Dogma 2.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, not early access.
What about before that?
I bought all the Alan Wakes recently, and I started playing Alan Wake 1.
All of them as in?
Three. One or two.
It's two Alan Wakes.
Yeah, there's two Alan
Wakes. All two of them.
Yeah. All two of them.
Yep. Okay.
What else did I get? I got a few things. I got a few things, but I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah. Look, you know what, Blake? I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for.
I haven't bought many early access games.
Is it because
in a while.
we've mercilessly ridiculed?
No.
Does that mean that we're the most recent ones on this podcast to have bought an early access game
because of
that Deep Rock?
Deep Rock Survivors.
Yep.
Now the times have changed.
Yeah, probably. But you know what? That's also a game that's mostly complete.
Yeah, it was.
And you know what? It's fine.
Will you play when it comes out?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think that they've got some issues with their difficulty curve they need to sort out. We can talk about that. But I want to, before we dive into Dragon's Dogma 2, I'm curious about it. Paul, have you been playing anything?
I have. I've been playing. I made it through the first Final Fantasy VII remake.
You made it through as you finished it?
I finished it.
And how was it?
It was good. I think I really enjoyed it. I've been playing the new one, so it's hard to separate the two already. There's a seriously weird thing where none of what you did in the first game matters when you start the second.
Wow,
which
what?
I didn't know. And that was disturbing.
That's insane. How does that? How
so, like,
does that
you, it's just grind a second game. For, you can like grind your characters or whatever, and then nothing carries over.
Yeah. Well, luckily I didn't, but
holy.
I'd still been trying to like find all the things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah. Like, you go into the second one, and there's no way to transfer your save. You can.
So how does
buy,
it? Sorry to interrupt, but like materia, for example.
Yeah.
Presumably, you're getting materia in the first one.
Yep.
And like. Socketing it and gear
and upgrading gear and you do
and
all
then
that.
So the second one starts up and your character has what?
None of that.
That's insane.
You can import one summon if you have a save file from the first game.
You can import one summon.
One summon. There's one summon.
This seems like a bad system.
Yes.
This seems like an error. Maybe they should have supported some sort of follow through.
I think so. It is a little bit weird though in that people had the first game for way too long for them to be able to balance the second game.
But
I also don't think there's actually, I suspect there's no way to do that. Import save data. No, just import save data from two separate titles on PlayStation.
Why? What you should, you could totally do that. Like,
only through a third-party service, though. You wouldn't be able to share. I don't think you can share.
Why not?
Storage. I just don't think you can. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but
it is a file. A game can look up a file and go, yes, this is the file. But here's the data I want.
Do all the games have permission to access other games' content?
But they're made by the same company. They should just be like, you have access to.
It can give them. They can give themselves permission.
Like this has been done.
The Witcher 3 lets you.
Oh, hang on, no, it must be doing something because it can tell that you've got a save game. Oh, that is different though.
And if it sounds like you can import something, one summon.
Mm. No, it just checks that you have a save.
But games have done. So games have done this in the past, right? Yeah. Where it's like,
have they though? Between two separate titles.
Yeah, The Witcher Mass 2 Effect. And The Witcher 3.
Okay.
Mass Effect. Lot of like BioWare.
Telltale games.
Yeah, Telltale games especially.
Yeah. Oh yes, that's a good point.
There's been countless examples of games with like separate games with.
So that means it was entirely a design decision.
And it was probably a case of, this seems like a balance problem. Or we don't want people who didn't get the first one to feel like they're missing out on the second one. But I would argue, for example, The Witcher 3 lets you carry decisions across from Witcher 2.
Mm.
Mm.
I didn't play The Witcher 2. I have it. I didn't play it.
Yep.
And it didn't stop me from playing The Witcher 3. But if I were to discover that my stuff in The Witcher 2 didn't carry across The Witcher 3, that would probably put a damper on my desire to buy The Witcher 3.
I don't know if your stuff from Witcher 2 carries across to Witcher 3.
Maybe not your stuff.
I mean, your decisions do.
Yes.
But I don't think your stuff would because
that's
it's basically set years after.
That's fine. I'm not saying everything. When I think about Final Fantasy VII, I don't want my level 99 cloud or whatever to carry across. That's fine. I don't care about that. But if, for example, my cloud has a specific set of materia equipped, it doesn't need to be the same level.
Yeah.
But I would like it to be the same setup. You know what I mean? Like, it can be, they can down level it to get it to the balance that is appropriate.
Yeah.
And I want decisions, like, if I've helped a character out in Midgar and they show up later in the game, I want them to.
Yeah, you want your decisions to carry over. Yeah. How do these games work? Because I thought that they were basically remaking the discs.
No, they've split them into separate games. Even the combat is different in the second one to the first.
Yeah.
Really?
The second one isn't even the second one is still part of the first disc of the original Final Fantasy.
Right. That's so confusing. I'm so confused by this.
The second Final Fantasy. I didn't play it for like a week just trying to figure out.
Just in your head going, what is going on?
Paul's just holding a controller going, what is this?
Like, actually, that was pretty much.
Yeah. Because I thought that they were essentially like remaking the disc. So it's like, but okay, the bad shitty thing is that you got to pay $100 for each disc, but it's just like, here's the first third of the game as one game. Then you buy the second third of the game.
It's not even, it's 150. I'm pretty sure. Oh my it's God. Obscene.
That's insane.
You can't, I think I got it for like 120 or something. A physical
bargain.
Well, compared to 150, it kind of is. Yeah. I mean, you can spend more though.
It's a bargain.
If you get the digital version,
Or like the collector's editions.
Oh yeah,
$300 for $50 for the plastic or whatever.
Oh, I mean, it's still this is a bargain compared to how much the digital copy of Dragon's Dogma is.
Yeah, well,
how much is that?
It's like $130.
Okay.
Ridiculous. And I've heard, well, we'll get to it in a minute, but I've heard that Dragon's Dogma 2 is in some ways kind of a remake or reimagining of Dragon's Dogma.
Maybe, but I never played it, so it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm completely fine with that. Yeah. I think a lot of people are in my basket of who they'd heard of Dragon's Dogma 1.
Yeah.
Because it got a little bit of a cult.
It has some buzz.
Yeah. It I don't think it was a huge hit when it initially came out, but it grew.
Yeah, and they did it like a Dark Arisen, which was
So
it's funny because they did Dragon's Dogma, kind of came out sort of mediocre reception.
Mm.
Then they did Dragon's Dogma Dark Arisen, which was like the souped up version of Dragon's Dogma.
Right, yeah.
With extra content.
Yeah.
And now they're doing Dragon's Dogma 2, which is like a reimagining of Dark Arisen.
I mean, maybe I don't know what, I mean, I don't know what the stories of original Dragon's Dogma were, but maybe they're doing the Star Wars thing where it's like, it's just retelling the same thing over and over.
It's poetry. It rhymes. Yeah.
There's always a bad dragon to kill. And
don't Google that, by the way.
Great. But anyway, Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
Like, so they're completely separate games then?
Except that it carries on the story.
See, that's what gets me, man.
It really threw me.
I thought they were supposed to be connected. Like, you play the same...
The story is connected.
Yes, but you're...
But the connection is regardless of your actions, right?
Yes.
Does it ever come up, like, when you start it? Well, I guess maybe you didn't because you played the first one. So it doesn't... It must carry your actions, though, right?
Final Fantasy VII is very linear.
Yeah, there's no actions that in the first one that would have mattered.
Okay.
In the original Final Fantasy, there would have been some relationship progression.
Yeah.
Based off things you do early on, but...
There's no relationship tracking in that game, though. It's
in the first one, yes, there is.
No.
Yeah, because who you go on a date with changes depending on different conversation settings.
You can go on a date in the original?
In the Gold Saucer. There's a date segment and different dialogue options you chose at different points in the game.
We're digging down deep into the memory archive right now.
I don't even know why I remember this, but
I know that they've remade it for. I know that there's date stuff in the remake, but that's the Gold Saucer is now what you're up to. Like, you're not...
Not yet.
But it's in part two of the remake.
Yes, I think it is.
It's in disc one of Final Fantasy VII. Again, the fact that they had to split the first disc into two games is silly. But hey.
Yeah, it was a good 40 hours of the first game before I completed it.
Yeah, in the original? Or
in the new one.
Or the remake. Again, silly, because it's like 12 hours of the actual original Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. And there's not even a lot of... It's got heaps of cutscenes, heaps of just story.
Yeah, classic JRPG stuff. I think it's interesting. JRPGs have become, in some ways, more self-indulgent.
Yeah.
There's cutscenes for everything. There's... lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of dialogue. I don't know if this is the case with all JRPGs, but a lot of the ones I've been playing lately, there's a lot of repeat dialogue.
Oh.
It's important for the story that you understand that this character has this relationship.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so they will display it like four or five times and in different ways.
Mm.
But you just like, I get it. This person doesn't like this person.
Yep.
I get it.
Yep.
In some ways, I kind of don't like that.
Yeah, but that can get annoying.
Yeah.
I haven't had much of that in the new Final Fantasy, but
okay.
I guess
I hate in books as well.
Who reads books nowadays, though?
Yeah, what?
Nerd. Go back to playing video games, nerd.
Yeah, I only read Twitter.
I read Reddit comments.
Yeah, just the comments. I read the comments on news articles, not the news articles themselves.
I read the headline.
I think the thing that throws me, right, is that this is a remake of one game. and it's split into however many games. Yep. So I, because it's a remake of one game, in my mind, like your character would cross over between those games.
I think that's
what's throwing me. Because I was just thinking like something like Mass Effect or Dragon Age, like I expect my decisions to cross over, but I'm not fully expecting my loadout and guns and upgrades to like cross over.
I don't want the power to cross over. Like I don't want my level to cross over. I don't want my material level to cross over.
But because it's a remake of one game, like it's one game, that I think is in what set that expectation for me.
Yes, I would fully expect for if I have a specific sword, I would expect to have that specific sword equipped when I load up the next.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless there is like an explanation, unless there is like a time gap where Cloud goes on a vacation and then he gets attacked by a bear and loses all of his gear.
Zelda, right?
There is a little bit. There is an explanation, kind of, or it alludes to an explanation.
Okay.
But talking about that bit of it would be very spoilery.
Okay. So. Well, let's not bring it up on the podcast. But after the podcast, I'm going to grill you.
Yep, yep.
But Blake just brought up a good point, which is Zelda.
Mm.
Tears of the Kingdom directly follows Breath of the Wild, and Link has all the stuff when that game starts. And then he loses it.
Yeah.
In fact, he may have more stuff than you have when you finish Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I like that.
Yeah.
What I don't like is that they get rid of all of the old shrines and a bunch of other old world elements and never acknowledge that.
Yes. I don't like that, and I don't like that the beasts are just not there.
Yeah, the divine beasts
are
gone. Yeah, I kind of wish my guess is it was a design decision that if someone had not played the original, they would wonder what these things are. How do I interact with them? They seem like they're significant and important.
But they could literally just have them sitting there. They don't have to do anything.
That's what I'm saying, though, is if you haven't played Breath of the Wild, you pick up Tears of the Kingdom, and there's these four giant monsters.
They've already got weird stuff like that. Like, they've got hints to past Zelda games as basically Easter eggs.
Huh?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I mean, not in a way that is so. There's no giant looming Ganondorf. No
clear connection, you mean? There's no clear connection.
Not just that, but there's no. If you're trying to make a game that is fairly focused, and I would say that the Zelda games are pretty focused.
Yeah.
They have fairly minimal mechanics that let you do lots of stuff, right? What they don't want are these things that players are going to assume are interactable or are important for story purposes.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's these giant divine beasts. Surely I must be able to get inside them and do stuff.
Yeah. I get it. But surely there's a better way than just never having them there and not mentioning them.
Fully agree.
Whatsoever.
Fully agree.
So you as the player are like, where are they? And no one in the world is even mentioning them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think, for example, that the old shrines could have been like, they could have still been there. They could have collapsed.
Yeah.
And they could have like little monsters. Like it could be a monster camp or bandit camp or something.
Because like, I mean, you say you don't want like new players to be confused, but if you had stuff like that, wouldn't that make you go, wow, what are these things? Maybe I should play the first one.
Yeah. I don't disagree.
Maybe there should be a sign that says, when Zelda interacts with it, says, boy.
Boy, I sure wish I remembered this.
What was this again? I guess I'll have to go back and...
And then the Nintendo eShop pops up.
Do I feel something in my hair? Is that the Breath of the Wild?
Boy, that was such a crazy adventure I had. Boy, I can't describe the things. You just had to be there.
I wish I could experience it.
Yeah.
I wish I could experience it. No, I agree. You've been playing Balatro as well, right?
Yes, yes.
And you really like that.
Yeah.
So what was that again? Can we recap what that was?
Balatro, I have barely looked into it, but my understanding is a poker-based roguelite.
Yeah.
So you gather powers, and it's about getting poker hands that will deal damage to your opponent.
All it really is a series of stages where you have to get a higher score each time to beat the thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll have three matches you've got to do.
Yeah.
The third one will be, I think it's called the Big Blind.
Big Blind.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like the boss of that. I'm not even sure that's what it's called. But yeah, the third one is the harder one of the three, and it'll have a certain modifier that's random.
Yeah.
And yeah, essentially, you've just got to get a higher score each time to keep progressing.
Yeah.
And the goal is to make your way through eight of these three matches.
Yeah. And it's a higher score than your opponent, right?
You don't actually even have an opponent, really. It's the opponent is just the score that you've got to beat.
Okay. So they
it's really just a game about scaling.
Yeah.
And along the way, you'll have shops where you can swap out cards, do various random things. So you're trying to build your deck into being something that is going to get higher and higher scores.
Mm. Yeah.
And you've got to beat the scaling of the score that you're playing against.
Yeah,
I see. And it's all poker hands.
It's all poker hands. Oh, and, cool. But you can do absurd things like change your deck so much that five of a kind becomes possible.
Oh.
Which is not in a regular That's deck neat. Of cards.
Yeah, yeah.
There's even like flush full houses that you can get to because you've got both three of a kind and two of a kind of the same suit.
What type of poker is it? Because there's different types of poker, right?
Is it just a hand of five?
It doesn't have the flop draw or anything.
Nah. Texas Hold'em.
Yeah.
You draw, I think, eight cards.
Okay.
By default.
And discard three or something?
You have three discards in which you can discard up to five cards. Okay. So it's not like regular poker.
Yeah, yeah. It's
modified. Just using poker hands as the thing that it's based on.
I getcha.
It's other than that, really just like a deck builder where you're trying to get a higher score each time.
Now, is there like a mini game that is like essentially a full open world RPG that Blake would ignore?
No. But I mean, you can maybe have something else running in the background.
Yeah, this is
and just swap between.
This is
the
inside
two.
Final Fantasy you're talking about, right?
Here is a card game in Final
this
Fantasy.
This is in the this Golden Saucer.
No. Final Fantasy is inside of this.
There's a real like Frog Fractions kind of thing going on.
By the way, sorry, did you know that there is a Frog Fractions 2 that exists?
I do know there is. I don't know what game it's in though.
It's in some sort of fairy city builder game.
Oh, weird.
I should look into it.
Yeah. Is it refreshing that it's poker hands and not like fantasy cards?
Yes, it is a very refreshing game in general. I hadn't played anything like it. I know Nick told me about Solitarica, which is another card based roguelite.
Yeah.
But
you were not keen on it.
Nah, I don't like that one. I admit that it's got like good ideas, but. It's very difficult to get into compared to Balatro.
That's possible. I think that one of the biggest... I love Solitarica. I still think it's one of the best mobile games ever made. I think the biggest issue with Solitarica is that the starter class they give you is so vanilla that you don't get to see any of the wacky things that you can do with the other classes.
Those are... you got to pay for the others, though, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. Which I don't think is a terrible...
business model?
Yeah,
I think it's a great business model.
But maybe if that... default one you get is a little more interesting. It might hook people more.
The thing is that the default one doesn't actually contain any unique powers, whereas all the other classes have a unique power, and you could also play as the default one essentially if you wanted to.
Right. I did try a couple of the others. I did like buy it. And
oh, did you?
Yeah.
Did you play the Rogue? The Rogue is probably the most fun.
Yeah, I did play the Rogue.
You get these like crazy long chains. Mm. You can get tons of gold. You can then make a wild build where you essentially never give the opponent an opportunity to attack, or if they do attack, you reflect the damage back to them.
Oh, wow, cool.
Like, you can do all sorts of wacky stuff.
I never got to that. But I do really just think it has a big problem with onboarding. Because early on, the game leaves you in situations where you can't do anything except draw often. There is a big time even between drawing And it just that gameplay.
That sounds like a skill issue.
It might be.
Because those weapons, like those skills are designed to like let you chop away a card that is blocking, for example. Something that would let you roll. So you save your spell points and you use them to unlock like access to other cards.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you don't know what those cards are. It's like I'm talking about early on in a run. Unless you have
certain powers.
Yes. But you don't have that early on, right? That's true. So the start of the game is the series of playing and not knowing what you could have done better. It gives you no feedback. And then most of the gameplay decisions are out of your hand. Like you don't have a choice in what you're doing near the end of a run, near the end of the early matches.
I don't know that I agree with that. I see where you're coming from.
Mm.
But when you are classic solitaire. This is solitaire tactics, though, right? Did you play much solitaire?
A little bit, a long, long time ago.
Yeah, I haven't played much solitaire in a long time either. But like, oftentimes you're given a choice between two possible cards that would like fit the next card that you want to flip.
Yep.
Right, and one may reveal more cards than the other, or may lead to more options down the road. And it's about it has this a little bit of that like, The result, current result may be equal, but one is going to produce more opportunities eventually. And
yes,
you have to consider that part of it when you're making your basic like
card selections. You have no knowledge of what's going on in either of them.
But you know this one will flip one card and this one will flip two, right? Like that's a thing that can happen.
Yes.
And so you go, okay, well, I want to flip two. But it might also be that, okay, the one I want to flip one of will flip two later, and the one I want to flip two of will have nothing behind it.
Just most of the time you don't have that information, though.
You can see how many cards are behind a card, though.
Yes.
Yeah. So that you can determine how many cards will be flipped next time or the time after that.
I'm misunderstanding. Okay. For sure.
That's fine. That's fine. Look, Solitaire may not be for everybody. I still think it is.
I'm now wondering if I was playing it entirely wrong.
Or I'm going to make you play it in front of me after the podcast. No, I'm kidding.
You're so militant with like how people have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're having fun wrong.
Yeah, exactly. But Balatro sounds fun. I'm probably going to have to pick it up quite soon because it was one that I think kind of took the internet or at least Steam by storm to some degree. It sounds really fun. The way you're describing it, it sounds like it has some of that like fun deck building, crazy scaling that like a good roguelite has. I also, just from what I saw of it, they've done a really good job of making it juicy. You know what I mean?
Like it feels like there's lots of options, lots of things to do. There's, I think, maybe 10-ish starter decks that you can unlock. And you've got to go through the difficulty progressions with each of them. I will say, though, that the game definitely gets worse as the difficulty goes up. Because one of the things that made it so fun early on was that you could, based off what sort of jokers are, the jokers, you have 5 slots for jokers, and they'll have different kinds of things that different kinds of ways they'll affect your score. So they're kind of like a thing that impacts your overall deck.
Yeah.
Might have like x3 mults
to
your score if you meet a certain condition. But based off which ones of those you find, you can kind of make almost anything work. But as the difficulty goes up, though, each level requires a higher and higher score.
Yeah.
As one of the ways they've made increase the difficulty.
Yeah.
But that just makes less things possible.
Yes.
Which I'm not a huge fan of. I think the difficulty becomes very chance based rather than trying to make the most of like the things you have. I don't like the way the difficulty scales so much.
So you're saying there are like hands that give a certain score that then become useless as
the multiplier might not be high enough.
Yeah.
So all the things that you could like just skim by with early on are no longer a thing.
Right.
But I kind of, I see where you're coming from, but I also think that's fine. What that does,
I do think it's fine.
It pushes you to change your deck and look for other strategies. I've been playing this game called Peglin. I think I may have talked about it
briefly
last time. And it is Peggle, but or Pachinko, but a roguelike.
Yeah, yeah.
And similar scenario where like there are certain things that may be fine early on, and then unless you get other prerequisite parts of a, you know, it's, for example, you might have a version where you deal damage every time you use a certain kind of ball.
Mm.
And unless you start getting something that will heal you, you're just going to die.
Yeah.
Right? So that's just a strategy that does not work long term, but works short term.
Mm.
Or you might get lots of healing stuff, and eventually your opponent's damage will outscale your ability to heal unless you're getting something that deals more damage. Right? So you have to start looking for different like plugs to fill gaps in your build.
Yeah.
But that is not strictly score-based. There's strategy, and there's skill, and there's luck involved in that game.
Mm.
I do also, just before we wrap the podcast, I want to hear about Dragon's Dogma 2.
Mm.
Blake?
I haven't played a heck of a lot of it, but what I've played is pretty great.
Yeah.
It's basically kind of standard fantasy open world.
Yeah, the at least the original the style of fantasy they chose was like classic dragons.
Yeah,
and medieval. Like it is so classic. Everyone talks about Doth Thou.
Yeah, Doth. Actually, that's something that really got me, and it actually really draws you into the world because their language is like so ye oldie. Yeah, which is kind of neat. And their whole world of, you know, just a classic medieval fantasy, but they do just have like these monsters properly out in the environment in ways that, and the way that the civilization interacts with them is fairly realistic. Like they're always worried about monsters on the road.
Yeah,
you know. So when you take like their fast travel system is an ox cart that you pay for and then travel, and you can literally travel in it in real time, so it's not very fast travel. Or you can like
skip,
take a nap,
right,
and then you'll wake up at the end, or you might get attacked on the road and you'll be woken up when there's an actual monster attack that you have to like help out with.
That's cool.
So it
I like that.
Yeah, I really like that too. And like it really makes it feel like the world is like, okay, this is an actual like real thing that that these monsters are out there that they're always worried about. And you'll just see like griffins flying around as well. And I hadn't seen one. There's an intro sort of cutscene thing that there is one, and you're like, okay, that's cool. And then I sort of, the game opened up to me at a certain point, and you get to sort of go out into the open world. And I was just walking along, and a big shadow just went over me. And I was like, what the hell was that? Uh-huh. And I looked up, and there's just like this massive griffin eagle thing just flying.
Griffin eel?
Eagle.
Oh, eagle. Okay.
Yeah. I haven't met I haven't met one of those yet. Maybe they're, who knows?
It doesn't sound awesome. The front half would be a bird and the back would be an eel.
Yeah. Like, isn't that like a super long, I mean, what we're at this point is describing like a dragon.
Yeah.
Like a Chinese style dragon.
Yeah, I suppose that is a, And the thing is, it didn't attack me because it was so high up. It just like flew by, like it's just part of the world.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then I ran over to like a clifftop to watch it, and it went so far away, and then like by behind some mountains, and I'm like, holy heck, it's just part of the world.
That's cool. I've been playing The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
And the monsters are very much bound to a location.
Yeah,
They will go for you.
I encountered a Cyclops fairly early on.
Uh-huh.
Now,
sorry, just did you climb on it?
Well, no, because here's the thing. I'm starting to wonder if I have chosen not the most engaging class.
Okay.
Because I picked Mage. Mm. And so I am at the back of the party shooting lightning bolts down on people. And that's fun, but
I don't get to
climb on anyone. Yeah. I don't get to like get in amongst it. I'm basically like constantly staying away from the monsters and relying on my companions to keep the monsters at bay while I cast lightning on them. Which is, I guess, fine, but like...
You can change your class,
though. Yes, I know. You can change your class.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering of doing that, but I mean, I do like the spells are starting to really like open up, you know? So I'm hit level 10 now. And I've got a few extra spells, and I've got some upgrades for my last spells, and it's kind of exciting to see like the spells that are opening up. Okay. Like there's one that just lets me like float.
Okay, like levitate.
Yeah. So I can jump, and it has a like little video tutorial, right? Uh-huh. Of like what it does.
Yeah.
And you know, you see the character jump, and you're like, okay, and float, and you're like. And you're like, okay, that's neat. But then they start casting spells as well while they're flying.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I'm just like, that does make sense. But I'm like, that's really cool.
I guess you avoid ground hazards. Yeah,
to get out of the way of combat. So you can just like float in the air.
How high up are we talking?
Not very high. Yeah. Not very high. So far, it's basically been like a double jump. But it's also like you basically have to jump off a ledge to even be able to like do it properly.
Okay.
So... You already have to be up high to begin with, and this just makes you go up higher.
Yeah. Okay.
I can use it to like also traverse, like gaps.
Okay, that's cool.
Which is great, and I did that once because I look out and I'm like it. I cannot tell where the borders of the world, like playable world, are.
Yeah.
Like there's mountains and stuff like that, but they look the same as the mountains that you're kind of. In anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, maybe I can get up there. Maybe I can do this. So I jumped across a ledge to a sort of plateau.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, this seems great. This seems... Start running, invisible wall.
Oh, no.
And I was like, what the hell is this? This doesn't... And it was not even difficult to get to. I didn't, like, do any crazy wall jump
nonsense. There a message that was like, you've reached the edge of the world? It was just straight up an invisible
wall? Well, it was weird because there's, like, an invisible wall that... Like there's a road right next to it.
Yeah.
So it just sort of like pushed me away from this cliff that was already there.
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know why, like I wouldn't have been able to get up this cliff.
Could it have been an invisible monster? Okay.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it was.
That was my last saving grace for that.
No. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was, I literally don't know. But it bugged me and I was like, this is a bummer because it was just a ledge that was very easy to get to.
Yep.
And there's like this weird square invisible wall.
You know what game has a bunch of annoying invisible walls?
What?
Elden Ring.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah.
We won't get into it.
But anyway, I'm really enjoying it. Yep. But I'm wondering if I should like mess around with other classes. The story is like fairly standard. I guess standard, you know. It's kind of just the world that is getting me, and like there's a camping system which I like.
Okay, like you have to build a tent.
Yeah, and then you have to build a tent and camp for the night.
Let's go.
And they're called pawns.
Yeah.
Your pawns will tell you when they're getting tired,
mm-hmm.
and I really like that because you're going down the road, you're adventuring. Doing whatever.
This sucks. And then, my feet hurt.
And then they start complaining.
I want to go home.
I mean, they do. They start going like, man, maybe we should look for a place to rest for the night, like blah, blah, blah. And they'll comment on things as well where they will point out things of interest in the environment.
Yep.
You know, they'll point out chests. They point out ladders all the time, which is the craziest thing.
Dude, a ladder. Whoa, a ladder.
Well,
dude,
ladder. When you're out in the wild, you're like, oh, that's cool. You know, you're out in the forest and someone's like, there's a ladder there. And you're like, whoa, where? But when you're in the middle of a city and they're like, there's a ladder over there. And you're like, well, of course there is. It's a city. What do you want
there's
with
a door there?
Yeah.
Hey.
And sometimes they
there's a road.
That's
we're walking on it. Yeah, but... Yeah, that's our point.
There's a ladder there. Maybe we should go up it. I'm like, why? It's
that's someone's house.
Yeah, that's someone's house. There is that disconnect of like, you can basically go into anyone's house and just take stuff from a chest.
Oh, Witcher 3 has the worst case of that, I'd say. Literally, even in the city, next to a guard,
yeah,
you can just grab stuff in most cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is kind of obscene.
There was a stealing. Is it? There was.
There is. Yeah.
You, but not.
If you're a bit click careless in specific cities and specific locations, guards will like turn around and start attacking you.
But I always find that a real disconnect in because I felt like that in Witcher as well, where it's like, why can't I just walk into
this pauper's house and I take all of their water?
Yeah.
And they say nothing.
Yeah.
They're watching me. And
I mean, they've been doing this since like Skyrim.
But even at least in Skyrim,
there is stealing thing is
is
stronger. Yeah.
In almost all cases, if objects belong to people,
yeah,
and if you take them,
yeah,
and they're looking and they see you, they'll go and tell a guard, and then it's a problem.
Yeah, that's true. That is a somewhat better system. In Dragon's Dogma, your pawns can have a certain amount of autonomy.
Okay.
They
will grab stuff.
They will just grab stuff out of people's houses. Yep. I was like walking past.
Oh, he's not with me.
I was literally like walking past someone's house, and one of the companions are like, "Oh, I'll go get that chest," and they just go into someone's house, and then I see this thing pop up, being like, "Ching!" That like some gold was deposited in my thing, and then they walk out. He just robbed a house.
In The Witcher,
never had a friend like that.
In The Witcher, I have explained it away as you're a Witcher. Mm. They don't want to like get killed.
They ignore you.
They just turn a blind eye, and it's fine.
But
it's more like you're running a gang.
Yeah, yeah. And like out in the wild, that works perfectly fine. Yeah. If you're walking down the road and someone's like, "Oh, I'll grab mushrooms," that chest, and you're like, "Well, yeah, or mushrooms, or blah blah blah." But when you're in a town, it is such a like disconnect.
Yeah,
because I was even like reluctant to go into people's houses because I didn't know the law system or whatever. Yeah. But now I think it's just anything goes. You can do whatever.
It's all your stuff. They're just holding it on.
Yeah, they're just holding on to it.
I would love it if there was a law system, as in like, you know, you steal stuff and then people will be upset.
Yeah,
but some of the pawns have like loose morals. Not all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But like,
yeah.
There's like a thief class.
Yeah, and there is a thief class.
But then there's also like a bruiser, and like the thief class will steal stuff and he'll get away with it a lot of times. Yeah. And the bruiser will steal stuff and he will not get away with it a lot of times.
Well, this would align perfectly with their I can't remember what it's called, but they have they have personalities.
Yeah.
There's like maybe like four or five ish or so personalities.
Okay.
And one of them is like they will prioritize gathering stuff and taking stuff over fighting. So you can have a straight up thief class. Sure. They're great for like if you're out in the wild, they'll just like run off gathering stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And they're great. And then there's other personalities that are like, I just fight. I just want to fight. Yeah. That's it. I'm not worried about anything else.
I'm not gonna bend over and pick stuff up.
No, I'll stand right next to a chest and I'm not gonna open it.
I'm covered in armor. You have any idea how hard it is to bend down?
Yeah, yeah. It's
how many companions can you have?
You can have three.
Okay.
It sort of simulates like a four-person party. Mm, yeah. And it's a purely single-player game, which I find really interesting. Like, they have chosen, as a design direction, they said, we'll make it feel like a multiplayer, but it will not be multiplayer.
Mm.
They have online stuff. Like, for example, pawns that you can hire come from other players.
Yeah, I did hear that.
Yeah, that is a neat thing. Like, you go to this, like, Waystone thing, and you see a selection of pawns, and you can see like who made them and all this sort of stuff. And then you can get your main pawn. You can give him a quest. Mm. Basically you can set him up with a quest for another real world player.
Mm.
And then after you've rested at an inn, if a real world player had used your pawn, your pawn then tells you.
That's
and
cool.
And gives you like a rundown of what they did.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, we adventured over here and we went into someone's house,
we opened up their chest, we took all their gold. It was great.
And it's like really cool. And you can, you can get through this system, because you can assign a quest to that pawn, it will hopefully entice another player to use your pawn because you'll give them a reward as well.
Yeah. That's a good system.
Yeah, and you can get something back. So I've got my main pawn. I got him to set a quest to like kill a cyclops, so he gets like some badge, which like increases his, you know, whatever stats or something. And so I've set that, And then I'm hoping someone could just level up my pawn for me, basically.
I do think it's very funny that you're like, I've set him with this quest, and the reward is like some stats or whatever. Like, you have no idea what the reward is.
Well,
the important thing is that there's a reward.
The thing was, the badges, like, they do something really good, but I don't remember what it is.
Okay, great.
Because a tooltip did pop up when we're talking about badges, and they're like, oh, yeah, pawns with badges, you know, they're like better at this and better at that and whatever. Yeah. And I was just like, yeah.
Oh, dear.
But I mean, I can just go back and look.
Someone has written those
tooltips. I know. But the tooltips, like, I really did skim through a lot of them. I'm just like, yeah, I'll figure it out.
You bumhole.
Yeah, I know. But the cool thing with the tooltips is that they are stored in a very clear place. There's not actually that many of them.
Okay.
So I can, if I want to look up what those badges actually give me, I can just go to that bit and be like, oh, yeah, it's like whatever, increase stuff.
Would you recommend this game? Because this is the current controversy.
Yeah.
Completely taking the game itself out of the equation is... It's a big, expensive game, and it also has lots and lots of cosmetics and
transactions
or whatever they kind of penny pinch you for.
Yeah, I've not looked at the microtransactions for it at all.
On Steam, it has like a very, very low rating.
Yeah, because of this. Yeah,
gamers do not like paying for a game.
Yeah.
And then having to potentially pay for other things.
Well, yeah. Also, it wasn't announced, right, that it would have microtransactions.
And I think that might actually... Paul, you raise a very good point. I think that might be the actual issue.
I think so, because I was reading through the reviews, and you get past like the majority of the negative ones, and there's someone all the way down there that's like, oh, you don't need to buy the thing.
Yeah.
You can do it in game. You just need to get... So this was for reskinning your character.
Okay.
There's a $3 microtransaction that
right.
you can pay to make your character look different.
Yeah.
And there's some other way to do it that was quite
like involved.
It just wasn't clear. I think.
Right.
I think it was something like you had to get like 500 gold and then go to a dude to buy a thing and then take that thing to the barber.
Yes.
So I think it was not clear that people didn't know that there was microtransactions in it. And then the thing they wanted to do was also like hidden from them.
Yeah.
So it seemed like the only way to do it was microtransactions.
So I think this is a really interesting one. And I would love to find out what the dynamic between the developer and the publisher is. Because this is a game that has gone out of its way to create friction between a lot of systems.
Mm.
Right? So for example, the quick travel system that Blake just described, it is not A to B instantaneously. Mm. It is A to B at the pace of a cart. And... also, you'll get attacked sometimes.
Also, you can get attacked, but you could also not get attacked. Like, I did the whole, like, take a nap, and then I was, like, straight there.
Did you have to pay money to use the cart?
Yes.
More friction, right?
Yeah.
So there's... did you have to go to a specific location?
Yes, at a specific time of day.
There you go.
Yeah,
so there's lots and lots of different parts of friction, and I've read a little bit about this. This is a very intentional design choice. The designers want the world to feel real. They want a lot of friction because they want players to, like, explore the world on foot.
Yep.
Right?
Like I was,
I'm a big fan of this perspective.
Yeah,
I was because in Witcher, right? I basically never engaged with the fast travel system until way near the end when I was just like going around collecting armors from hidden chests.
Yeah,
because
it's fun to run around.
It's fun to go around, you know. And and even the same in Skyrim. Like I'd never engaged with the fast travel system. Until like way later in the game, you know,
when it's like I've explored all the spaces between A and B, I want to see which path B.
So you just go ba-doom.
So this is a game that is like that, right? They've created a really dense, thick, fun world, and they want players to run around in it. Now, then there's all these all these microtransactions that cut past this friction. So my question is, was this a late decision by the publisher? Who saw this as a way to make more money, who predicted that there would be players who found these systems annoying and said, we will charge players for this. Because that's my guess. My guess is the designer had the game designer and the game director, the developer had this vision for a world with friction that causes the player to play a specific way they feel will be advantageous and fun for the player.
Yep.
And the publisher said, we think there's going to be money in shortcutting this.
Mm.
And we are in charge, so put these in.
Could be. I don't know. Because I really like the friction that they've added there, and I would not want to buy fast travel tokens or whatever to
spend money to not play the game.
Yeah, yeah. I'm literally spending the money to enjoy the game less.
So here's my theory, is if the game had, if during press and reviews and whatever else, the game director or whatever, you know, someone had said, we've got all this friction in the world. We really think it's more fun to play this way. However, we will include an option for people who want to pay to shortcut these things. Because we think if you really, really care about it, we don't really want you to do this, but you have the option to spend $3 and do
it. Yeah.
That would probably have been received much less poorly.
Mm.
It wouldn't have been received well. You know, people would still be like, this is dumb.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they would know about it. It wouldn't be like review bombed. Mm. That's my guess.
Because it got slammed on Steam.
Yes. And you're saying it's like a fun game that you're having a good time.
It's great.
Right?
Yeah.
Everyone that I've talked to that's actually playing it is having a good time.
So I think that's...
Admittedly, that's like three people.
Also, everyone I've talked to about it, which also was like maybe two people, they have not bought any microtransactions.
Yeah.
Like they are on board with the friction, you know? Yeah.
I think this is a classic case of a publisher screwing over the studio by doing bad PR.
It's who's the publisher? Is it Capcom?
Yeah.
And it's
a first party studio.
Yeah.
So like there's a studio owned by Capcom.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't think that the game director was like blah blah blah, let's put this.
What if they had
this has also happened in Devil May Cry.
Oh yeah.
And other Capcom games recently where they have a bunch of like lots and lots and lots of like $2-3 microtransactions that for things that can be unlocked in game or that are pure.
That's interesting.
Do these things pop up in game as a way of being like, hey, go buy this thing with real money?
No. It's not like a mobile game.
Yeah.
It is almost certainly just a flag that is like quickly built into the system, probably late in the process to shortcut a design decision.
It's funny because I don't care as much if it's not advertised in game that there's something I can optionally pay for.
At least I've not seen anything at all that has.
That's so weird.
That has said anything like that.
I think also the base price of the game is a big part of this problem.
Yeah.
It is like $150 on Steam.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's obscene. Probably the most expensive game I've ever bought.
I don't know. I have a weird relationship with the price of games because one, I play on console, so I have to pay more. And two, I can't see how games can always launch at the same price for the last however many years. I think games have to.
They have crept up. Like $120 is not unheard of.
But
this is like 130 New Zealand, which is like the most so far.
Yeah.
I've just seen. Like on console, that's normal.
Well, on console, you're paying a licensing fee, and you are doing that for Steam as well. But I suspect console licensing fees are more expensive because you're paying for Sony to vet the game, to do like we've dealt with publishers and at Grinding Gear Games, and there's a lot of work that they do on their end, and they take a cut of sales.
Yep.
On top of that, the reason games could stay basically the same price for 30 years is just scale.
More people playing them. More
people are buying games. It used to be that a console would sell a few million, and that was huge.
Mm.
Like there'd be like 10 million Nintendo 64s in the US or whatever, and that was like a lot.
Yeah.
And now 10 million is like a failure for a system, right? It's the PlayStation sold like, PlayStation 4 was like 80 million in the US or something like that. So it's just there are more games, consoles out there. There are more games being sold. There's also more platforms.
Mm.
Like most games are cross-platform nowadays. There are not that many console exclusives. And a lot of them also go on PC. So you can do the same amount of work and sell it across three platforms for a much, much larger audience. So the price doesn't need to go up.
It does require more work to do it on more platforms, though.
Yes, there is more work. But it's not... It's not triple the work.
No, not to do. Yeah, I see what you mean.
So that's the big part of why the price is. Now we might be hitting a critical point, you know, where there are.
I know, I feel like games were $60 for a real long time.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, most are still, you know, under 100 easy.
Yep.
It's these like big tentpole ones. Like Diablo 4 was, I think I paid 120 for it. And this is like 130. So really, it's not even.
I think I might. I'm pretty sure it was 150 on Steam. You might have gotten a discount.
No, there was a like collector's type edition one that was like maybe one. I don't think I got it for 150. That's like, I don't think I'd spend that much. But maybe I did. I don't know. I don't think I did. I'm pretty sure I did.
It's expensive, though.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what I'm saying is that these big, big games, like, justify their price. But the majority of games, you know, of games I buy, I'd like easily under 100 all the time.
Yep. I mean, Vampire Survivors is $2.
Yep.
Right.
Like, I mean, Bellatro was 30. I think a lot of roguelikes are around the, like, $20 to $30 price point.
Like $20 to $30 is usually what I pay. If I'm buying a game that's like $50, I am thinking like, do I really want to play this game?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'll wait for the sale.
Yeah, yeah. But then a big game, you know, like Dragon's Dogma, I'll
wait for the
play
sale.
I'll pay that.
All right. Well, we're out of time. And my little tablet is running out of battery.
Oh man, that tablet is just no good anymore.
No, it's a bad tab.
Yeah, bad tab.
If you've got any questions, you can email frenziedquestions@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. We're reading out questions at the front, which is good because the tablet dies halfway through the podcast.
And it's called Frenzied Gamer, so you should front load it with
Frenzied Gamer front load questions.
Yeah, front load questions.
And so frenziedquestions@gmail.com.
Yep, if anyone has anything to say about Dragon's Dogma, I'd love to hear it.
Yes.
I'm only a little.
Or if I don't know if you've heard of this game, Witcher 3.
Witcher 3 is what it is.
I've been playing through the Shakespeare play.
I just immediately imagined the Witcher, but he's just got a lisp. His name was Richard the whole time.
Witcher 3.
Oh no.
Now Geralt is like a toddler who's just learned to speak. That is the game on. Oh, you've got a Gwiffin? Oh, I take care of the Gwiffin.
Oh, no.
All right, well, we'll be back in a couple weeks.
I want to hear more about The Witcher as well, Nick, next time.
All right, we'll talk about it.
Because I talked about it exhaustively back and that's argued why with Severn about it.
I don't know that I need to talk about it, but I do. I have a lot to say about it.
I just want to know that my opinion was correct.
Severn was right the whole time.
Oh,
bad
no.
game. Bad game. We'll
how do you feel about GTA?
Weeks. A perfect game.
Oh, man.
All right. Back. Bye.
Bye.
You went through the Baron quest, right?
Baron quest. Yes, yes. Yeah, that's fantastic.
How did that end for you?
He's still alive.
Oh, he wasn't for me.
You killed the hags.
You saved
the thing under the hill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you see the consequences of saving the thing under the hill?
I googled them. Because I was like, I have this choice. I don't know what the choice means. And,
that's what I like. So there's games where, like, I feel like in a lot of video games, you are kind of, like, trained to just do what you're told.
Yes.
And
this is very shades of gray and a lot of hidden information. I'm really enjoying it.
But also the information is like, there's this weird, crazy monster demon thing that's trapped under this, like, thing.
Yeah.
Should I release him?
Yeah. Oh, he's telling me that that he's actually helpful. Or this weird beating hill heart is saying, it's pretty chill.
Yeah.
And,
but all visuals. This is why I got into, Auntie Ethel. I was helping her out the whole way. Like, I got her to, like, pluck out one of my eyeballs and, like, replace it. And I was fully down the thing because I was just like, despite her looks, I'm sure she's great.
No.
But everything else is screaming, she is a monster. You should probably not deal with her.
The old lady's going, you little shites!
Yes.
God, yes, we'll eat your brains.
Yeah.
Well, she seems cool. I like her. I think she's chill.
She's great. She's... but it's, yeah, it's that thing of like all signaling is saying this is a bad thing. But you're like, are they really though?
But, so like, I did this.